This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه ثم أما بعد to proceed. Today is our second class on fiqh المعاملات المالية or the fiqh of financial transactions. As per العمدة كتاب البيوع, the chapter on sales is the first chapter in this particular segment of fiqh or section of fiqh. Kitab al-Buyu', the book on sales. We started last time by addressing some of the, a brief introduction to the book on sales. We went over this brief introduction and then we talked about the definition of a sale, and we said that there are different definitions of transactions based on the object of the contract, based on the object of the contract, whether it is thaman, a price, currency, or mathmoon, a commodity or usufruct. So usufruct for commodity for commodity, commodity for currency for currency, and these would be different types of transactions. And today, inshallah, we will talk about the forbidden transactions. Today we will be talking about the forbidden transactions. However, Imam Ibn Qudamah, rahimahullah, in his book Al-Umda, gives us a list of forbidden transactions. So what we will try to do is we will try to provide a framework first where the items on the list will fit in, lay them in the framework like you lay pearls in a matrix. So we will need to figure out the matrix first. We will need to figure out the objectives of Sharia pertaining to this particular topic. We need to figure out the principles and guidelines, and then we talk about the detailed rulings. Because we have three different levels of abstraction here. We have, at the highest level of abstraction, we have the objectives of the Sharia. That's the highest level of abstraction. The objectives, the philosophy, the foundation upon which these ahkam are based. And then at a second level, a little bit lower from this, we have the principles and guidelines. And then a little bit lower from this, we have the detailed individual rulings. And then certainly lower than this, but that would not be considered even part of this framework, are the examples that the scholars of predecessors, our righteous predecessors, may Allah be pleased with them, regardless of their madhab, the examples that they provided in their books are examples that are pertinent, relevant to their times. Sometimes those examples, they're always helpful because they always enlighten us concerning the thought process. They always enlighten us concerning the principles and guidelines. But certainly we should not adhere to their examples because they are relevant to their times. We need to figure out, what is applicable to our times, and that is certainly important. So people who adhere to the individual examples and they don't give much consideration to the rulings and where the rulings came from, and don't give much, or don't have a deep understanding of the rulings themselves, and they don't have a deep understanding of the principles and the guidelines that govern those rulings, of qawa'id, qawa'id that govern those rulings. And they do not have a good understanding of al-maqasid that guide everything in the tree, the maqasid from which everything stems. Then certainly that is not fiqh. So what we will try to do, this may be applicable to fiqh al-biyu', but it is applicable in general to the fiqh of financial transactions. The entire segment, the entire section of fiqh titled fiqh al-mu'amalat al-maliyyah or fiqh of financial transactions. Some people translate it as fiqh of commerce. So what would be the most salient, the most characteristic features of the Islamic fiqh of financial transactions? What are the objectives of Sharia concerning this particular realm of human endeavors or human action, activity? So what do you think? What should we have? This word is familiar, equity. Equity is important in Islam. لقد أرسلنا رسلنا بالبينات وأنزلنا معهم الكتاب والميزان ليقوم الناس بالقسط ليقوم الناس بالقسط وأنزلنا الحديث في بأس شديد ومنافع للناس ليقوم الناس بالقسط so that people can establish justice, can establish balance, and we sent down the balance, equity, justice. That concept is extremely important, and we will see in our discussion how it permeates throughout the entire discipline of financial transactions. The other one that is particularly important in financial transactions, in Islamic financial transactions, is the concept of transparency. Transparency. This is a very important concept. Transparency. Okay. Now, another concept that, and we will see also, you know, we will provide the objectives, the principles and guidelines, and then we will address the detailed rulings and see where they fit within the framework. The third one would be accountability. Accountability. The fourth one would be what? Is it in your thing? Social responsibility. Particularly in Buyu', it would be social responsibility. If you widen this to basically human stewardship of planet Earth, then it will not be, you know, the khilafah. إني جعل في الأرض خليفة. I shall place an agent, you know, a vicegerent on earth. هو أنشأكم من الأرض واستعمركم فيها. He brought you forth from the earth and made you settle in it. But not only made you settle in it and commanded you to be good stewards and to develop it. استعمركم فيها. So he asked you to تعمروها. So develop it. Be good stewards of the earth. So if you widen the scope of our discussion beyond the biyu' or beyond sales, so it would be social and environmental responsibility. It would be social and environmental responsibility. All of this is within a framework, a wider, larger framework of a teleological worldview that recognizes devotion to God as the ultimate good. A teleological worldview that recognizes devotion to God as the ultimate good. And this is also very important because you could basically realize all of those objectives in a contract and conduct it during the time of Jama'ah, and the contract will be invalid and forbidden. So why? It realizes all of the objectives. It's equitable, transparent, accountable, responsible, yet it ignored that teleological worldview, that devotion to God. It is the time of Jum'ah, you should be both praying at this time. And if one of you should be praying, it is makruh for the other one to distract them from their responsibility, and it is haram for them to be distracted from their responsibility towards God. Okay. So that is basically the framework, the foundation, the philosophical underpinnings of Islamic financial transactions. Now, let us move on to some principles and guidelines, particularly about this chapter, which is Kitab al-Buyu', or the Book on Sales. And then it is in your document. There are two different ways of looking at this or approaches to making sense of this. Because when I start reading Imam al-Qudama, as if I did not give you this introduction, we may have not been able to make sense of the list of forbidden sales. You know, this is forbidden, that is forbidden. It's a list of forbidden sales. So I think that this is important for us to understand the wisdom and the ilal, also the effective causes of these ahkam. Two ways to look at this, and I will modify the document I sent you. I give it a little bit more thought. Classifications are classifications. They are not basically something tawqifi. They are not traceable to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, not part of the wahi. They are tools for us to have a better understanding of the subject. So we change classifications all the time. So don't get stuck with particular classification. My own classifications are basically to facilitate my understanding and whatever I think to be a good way of sort of making the subject a little bit more approachable by everybody. So one of the classifications is like a hardcore classification that I'll start with, which is, you know, the pillars, conditions, and hindrances that apply to this particular chapter. Al-arkan wa shurut wal mawana. And this is basically a summary. I'll give you a summary from Sharh al-Muntaha by Al-Buhuti rahimahullah. He provides this summary in Sharh al-Muntaha of the pillars. Sharh al-Muntaha is an important Hanbali commentary. So he provides summary of the pillars, conditions, and hindrances. And that is not my classification now. I'll tell you my classification later, but that is not my classification. That is an important classical classification. Scholars always talk about arkan, the pillars, the conditions, and the hindrances. For every action to be a valid action, it has to fulfill the arkan, the pillars, and the conditions, right? And we talked before about the difference between the arkan and the conditions, and we said the arkan are integral to the action itself. The condition are important requisites, but they're not part of the action itself. Wudu is a condition of the validity of salah, but wudu is not part of the salah. Qiyam and the recitation of al-Fatiha is a pillar of salah, is a rukn, a pillar, not a condition, because they are part of the salah. So they are called pillars, arkan. Whereas wudu and being clean, you know, having no najasa and all of that stuff, is not part of the salah, but is a prerequisite, a condition of its validity. So that's the difference between arkan and shurut, between pillars and conditions. And hindrances are things that will basically invalidate the action if they are present. Absence is required for the action to be valid. If they are present, they would invalidate the action. So how did they divide things into pillars, conditions, and hindrances, mawana. Okay, so in order for a contract in Islam to be a valid contract, what are the pillars of the contract? What are the arkan of the contract? You need two contracting parties. You need an object of the contract, or an object of sale in the case of sales. And you need a format that would be a valid format. So parties, and that is two, because you can't have a contract with yourself. And you need object of the contract, and you need the format, the sigha. So this is mahal al-aqd, and those are muta'aqida, and mahal al-aqd, and sighat al-aqd. So these are the three pillars that we need in every contract in order for the contract to be a valid contract. What are the conditions of a valid contract in this case? One, you will have to have the two parties, they have to be mature. They'll have to have reached majority or adulthood, not just puberty, but rushd. And rushd could come with puberty, a little bit after puberty, a little bit after that. It depends, you know, people are very different. And some people never get to it. But it varies. So rushd is maturity, or, you know, prudence, particularly when it comes to financial transactions, prudence. Maturity. The second one is at-taradi, and at-taradi is basically mutual consent, mutual agreement, mutual consent. And that's not coerced or forced consent, that is just like free consent, an act of free consent. So at-taradi is the second one. The third one is that this object, so these belong to the parties. They need to be mature and they need to be consenting. The third one of the conditions is that the object is owned by one of the two parties. You own the price, he owns the commodity, or she owns the commodity and she owns the price. The object needs to be owned. It needs to be sellable. Sellable Islamically. And we will come to address what this means. How is it, how could it be sellable or not sellable from an Islamic perspective? It needs to be, in addition to this, deliverable. Deliverable. So you have the ability to deliver it to the not deliverable, that it, no, I mean that you could actually give it, transfer the ownership and the position of the object to the other party, not that you deliver it to their home. So it needs to be deliverable. And 6 and 7, known. So 6 would be known. The commodity would be known, and the price should be known. 7, the price should be known. So known, price and commodity. We have to know both, you know, the price and the commodity. Okay, these are 7 conditions, right? Maturity, consent, owned, sellable, deliverable, known. We have to fulfill the pillars and the conditions. What are the hindrances? What would prevent something from being? What would prevent a sale that met the pillars and the conditions from being a valid sale? Well, it varies. So, like, basically, if it is during the time of Jama'ah, compromises your obligation towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. During the time of Jama'ah, I already also said if you have 5 minutes to pray Zuhr before Asr or 5 minutes to pray Asr before Maghrib, during that time, your sale is not permissible and not valid. Because your obligation at this time is to actually perform the prayer, not to be, conducting sales. So, if it leads to evil, if it leads to riba, usury, if it is socially irresponsible, and we would give examples of socially irresponsible sales. Socially irresponsible sales would be like nudge, which is basically provocation, which is to increase the price without any intent of buying yourself. Two people are trying to agree on a price, you come in the middle and you try to up the price, whether it is upon mutual agreement with the seller from before, or you just wanted to volunteer to make things harder for the buyer. Some people are like that also. So even if they would have no stake in it, no interest whatsoever, it would not benefit them whatsoever. They just want to make things harder for people. So that is a form of socially irresponsible, and we'll come and we'll discuss in more detail the rest of the socially irresponsible transactions. Like outbidding would be another socially irresponsible, provocation, outbidding, and so on, and interception of goods. So we will give examples. Okay. Leads to evil if you sell grapes to like a wine factory, for instance. If you sell weapons to warring enemies or gang members or something, and you know that these weapons will be used in haram ways. Leads to usury. There are many transactions that are not usurious in their essence, but they do lead to it, particularly bay' al-'ayna, where we agree, I sell you something, like I come to you, for instance, and tell you, why don't you buy this iPhone from me for, let us say, $500. And then the $500 will be due in 2 months, and sell it to me now for $300. Sell it to me for now in cash for $300. What happened here? You gave me sell it to me for $300. You took $300 from me, and I owe you how much? $500. You took $300 from me, and I owe you $500, so you will have to pay me $500. What happened here? We exchanged money for money. We did not have any interest in this product itself. Otherwise, you know, the product came back to me at the same time. The mirror image of this is also Aina. So this transaction and the mirror image of it are both Aina. What happened here is that, and Aina would be permissible in the Shafi'i madhab, but they were looking at it from the perspective of judges, not from the perspective of the actual individuals who are partaking in this transaction. So, but the majority forbids the bay' al-'ayna. What happened here is that you wanted some money in cash. We used this sale as basically a means of facilitating a usurious transaction, a means of halalizing a usurious transaction, in essence. So this leads to usury, although it is not usurious per se, right? Because both transactions were permissible. Like, if I come to you, if you are the seller, and I come to you, and I tell you, sell me, if I go to like a store and I choose an item and tell them, sell me this item for $800 in installments over 6 months. Okay? And then I take the item, and we both understand that it is sort of understood that this is not really a sale. I take the item and I said, this is halal, right? So far everything's halal. So I give you the item back and I tell you, why don't you pay me $500 for this. What happened here? And you give me the $500. I needed money. I went to you. I bought the commodity for $800 in installments. I sold it back to you for $500. So what is the end result here? The end result here is that I took $500 from you and I owe you $800. Where is the commodity? Back to you. It's in the same place. So what is the end result of this transaction? It is $500 for $800. So it is basically a trick to, and that is why the majority forbids this particular transaction. It leads to riba, even though the two arms of this activity are permissible, separate from each other. But if you take in consideration the niyyah here, it would not be permissible. In the Hanbali madhab, tawarruq is halal. Basically, you go and purchase a product from someone in installments and then go to someone else and sell it in cash because you need the cash. That, in the Hanbali madhab, is halal. Because it's not the same person. It is not the same person, so it is not basically money for money. You purchased it already. It's almost like a sale transaction. The two different sale transactions, but you're particularly interested in the cash, not the product. So you went to you went to a car dealer and you purchased the car with a halal sort of with halal financing over 5 years. You pay $40,000 over 5 years. You took that same car and you went to someplace else and sold it for cash. And what happened here? From your end, you will be paying $40,000 over 5 years, and you sold it for $35,000 in cash. So from your end, it is money for money. But since these are two different transactions with two different individuals, entities, it would be permissible. Okay, so... So these are the pillars, the conditions, and the hindrances. What about the classification, the other classification that, you know, I wanted like a more tangible classification. So what is a contract? You know, it's a process, object of the contract, and then extraneous factors. Factors extraneous to the process and the object. If you think of a sale, you have an object, and you have a procedure, you have a process, you know, a format. Okay, so that is the way I thought of this. And then I modified it a little bit. It would be different. What I will say now will be different from what I sent to you. I modified one thing a little bit, which is, socially irresponsible. I put socially irresponsible under extraneous. I would put it now under extraneous. I put it under process. I'll put it now under extraneous. So in a transaction, you know, I separated between equity and social responsibility. So I said here that in a transaction, when it comes to the process, what would make a transaction impermissible? Keep in mind, our mashayikh who dealt a lot with financial sort of agreements and sales and financial transactions and financing in general and so on, they told us that when they basically entertain the halalability of a contract, they would be looking, their eyes would be looking for riba, gharar, ghabn, usury, undue risk-taking, which is like gambling, and ghabn, which is inequity. And if they don't find the riba, gharar, ghabn, they are likely going to allow that transaction or ratify that contract. So in the, when it comes to the process, we have these riba, you know, gharar, which is undue risk-taking. Gharar would, they give examples to gharar, undue risk-taking. We will throw the commodities on each other, you know, like you have, whatever, you have dates, I have garments, clothes, pants, whatever. Whatever I throw at you and you throw at me, whatever, you know, is basically binding, a binding transaction. So it is by al-munabaza, which is by throwing or by touching. The thing that your hand will fall on first will be yours for this much money. Or by al-hasa, by throwing pebbles. And by al-hasa, throwing pebbles is when you throw a pebble and whatever it falls on is yours. Or you throw a pebble across the land and whatever it reaches of this land is yours for this much money. These are ridiculous transactions. They, you know, but keep in mind, humanity did not outgrow this. The thirst for gambling, the eagerness for gambling is sort of an ardent human deviation. People want gambling. And people want to infuse transactions with this sense of risk-taking and gambling and so on. And that sabotages these principles. And we will, when we come to the detailed rulings, we will see how each detailed ruling would be relevant to these divisions, the philosophical underpinning of financial transactions in general, and the basically the structure, the pillars, the conditions, and the hindrances. So gharar, undue risk-taking, gambling, but in transactions versus gambling in games. Okay, the other one it's called the ghabn. Ghabn means inequity, unequitable transactions. Inequity or unequitable transactions. And cheating would, you know, and like in the document that I sent you, I added socially irresponsible here. So inequitable and socially irresponsible. Let us take social irresponsibility and put it under extraneous and just focus here on inequity. Inequity would be like coerced, like cheating in transactions, like unfair conditions in the transactions, unfair conditions, cheating, coercion, these are all manifestations of inequity. And that would be what would violate the process. Now, ghabn in particular, ghabn in price, which is basically something different, you know, like to charge an exuberant amount of money. There is a lot of disagreement about this, and we will come to talk about the option of ghabn or khiyar al-ghabn, the option of ghabn. If you feel that you have been charged an exuberant amount of money, what recourse do you have, if you have any, in the different mazahib? But that is not, we're not limiting ghabn to that concept. We're just talking about ghabn in general, as a translation for inequity. Now, object, the object of transaction, when would a transaction be forbidden because of the object of transaction, not the process? You have inherently non-syllable objects, and you have objects that are non-syllable because of extraneous of some attribute, you know, that is not inherent to the object itself. Inherently impermissible objects are two different types: useless and haram. Useless objects and haram objects are inherently impermissible. We said last time that it is, you have to, there has to be a manfa'a mubaha. There has to be a permissible commodity or permissible usufruct for the transaction to be permissible. You can't sell insects, you can't sell dust to people and exploit their imprudence. You cannot exploit the naivety or imprudence of people and sell them something that is completely useless. And we said that this would not be expected in a secular law because taradi or mutual agreement will override this. But in Islam, Allah told us, وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ أَمَنُوا لَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ in two different verses. Do not devour or consume your money amongst yourselves unjustly. Unjustly. That will apply to the exploitation of people, their imprudence. Okay. And then we said haram. Haram would be two different reasons for something to be haram. Usually it is haram because it is najis, because it's filthy, it is najis. So najis would be the biggest category here, but there are certain things that are, because particularly khamr in the madhab is najis, wine, alcoholic beverages in the madhab are najis, not only najis ma'nawi, but also physically najis, materially najis, materially filthy. Anyway, whether you espouse that position or not, but that is what they say about khamr anyway. So you have carcasses, you have khamr, you have like pork, all of these things are haram to sell because they are najis. And then the non-najis items would be, you know, things like idols. Idols are haram to sell, although they are not najis. And then because of an attribute, they also add here alatillahu, musical instruments, usually in the form of zahib under the non-najis stuff that is haram to sell. And then because of an attribute such as something being haram to sell because of an attribute such as if it leads to evil, for instance. Such as if it is not owned by you, then it would be, whether it is misappropriated or it is owned by someone else and you are not authorized to sell it or something, it is not owned by you. And also because it leads to evil. And if it leads to evil, here, not that the process leads to evil. Sometimes the object leads to evil and sometimes the process leads to evil. When we talked about leads to evil here, we talked about the process leading to evil, destroying the social fabric of the society, hurting the social fabric of the society, causing, you know, ill feelings between, or hard feelings between the people by outbidding, by interception, by provocation. But here, the commodity itself leads to evil, such as selling grapes to a wine factory or something of that nature. And then, gharar, which is undue risk-taking. Sometimes, like some people consider gharar to be all about the commodity. And the majority of the scholars would say that there is gharar in the process, gharar in the commodity. Gharar in the process, they would give examples, throwing, sail by throwing, casting pebbles or you know, those like funny types of sales. And they give examples to gharar when it comes to the commodity itself, such as selling that which is absent, that which absent and has, you know, has not been described, that which is not deliverable, birds in the sky, fish in the water, you know, these kinds of sales, they give them as examples to gharar in the commodity itself. Some of the scholars, like Ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah, said that gharar is all about the commodity. There is no gharar in the process. Gharar in the process would go back to gharar in the commodity. It is basically unidentifiable commodity. So when you say that throwing pebbles, for instance, that the sale will be actualized by throwing pebbles, or like mutual casting of goods among yourselves, that again goes back, you know, to the commodity. At the end of the day, the sale, the object of sale, is not identifiable, not agreed upon, not identifiable. So I don't know which garment you will throw at me. Therefore, it all belongs to this category. Anyway, you understand the concept. The classifications are not a big deal. You know, you just want they sort of give us like a better perspective. But they're not, you know, part of the law, just classifications. Okay. Now, then we said extraneous, things that are extraneous. And the best way to divide, to classify things that are extraneous are things that will sabotage, compromise your obligations towards the Creator or your obligations toward the creation. These are extraneous. They don't apply to the process. The process is solid. The process is great. They don't apply to the object of sale. All the conditions have been met. But what about, like we said before, sitting during the time of Jummah? Is this about the process? No, it's not about the process. The process is perfect. You know, two mutually consenting, mature adults, and the object of sale is identifiable, deliverable. Everything is just perfect, but the time is not the right time. And then obligations towards the creation would be interception of goods, outbidding, provocation, and things of that nature. These compromise your obligation to the community, your obligations to the society, that your transactions should be socially responsible, should not exploit the imprudence of people, and should not create basically unnecessary intermediaries between the producer and the consumer, which will cause basically inflation of prices that is unwarranted and causes certain people to profit off of the profit of others who are less savvy. Okay, now this is basically the basic structure, and now let us apply the list of forbidden sales that Imam Ibn Qudama addresses in his book Al-Umda to these principles. He said, rahimahullah, ولا يجوز بيع ما ليس بمملوك لبائعه إلا بإذن مالكه أو ولاية عليه. It is forbidden to sell what one does not own without the permission of its owner, unless the property is in one's custody. Yeah, like, you know, you are the caretaker of, like, the property of an orphan, for instance. You're the father of an orphan. You take care of their property. His mother passed away. You became in charge of the property of the orphan. And so you have authority. You have custody now. But Anyway, so you have to either be a wakil or be the custodian or be the actual owner. You have to be the owner authorized to dispose of the property or to sell the property. But otherwise, it is not permissible for you to sell ma laysa bimamlukin lak, that which is not owned by you. Because the Prophet ﷺ said to Hakim ibn Hizam, and this has been reported in by Abu Dawud and Tirmidhi and many, many others, but many variations has been authenticated by many scholars, and this would be one of the foundational hadith that you want to remember in financial transactions, although the understanding of it is not always, you know, a matter of agreement between the scholars, and some of the contemporary scholars are also trying to have a modified understanding of it. But in concept, they all agree on this hadith. They accept it. They agree on its meaning. He said to Hakim, لا تبع ما ليس عندك. Do not sell that which you do not عندك. Which means what? Could mean possess, could mean own. You know, the interpretation of عندك, with you, that which is not with you, in your possession, or that which you do not own. You could translate it as either or. It actually means both. But in your position here, what is in your position here? It's not that basically that you have, like, you know, that you have possession of, even if it is a property in India and you're sitting here in this room now. But you possess it, right? You can deliver it. You can transfer the ownership. He can give the keys to the owner at one moment, so you possess it. Okay. But لا تبع ما ليس عندك. يا حكيم لا تبع ما ليس عندك. Do not sell which you do not possess. Is extremely important, and there are benefits that, you know, that is a main foundational hadith in the fiqh of financial transactions, particularly in the fiqh of sales. Also in financing, and this hadith will come back and be extremely important in the area of finance. لا تبع ما ليس عندك. Don't sell that which you do not own and you do not possess. The importance of this, one, is about accountability. So here we're talking about accountability. Capital has to be accountable. You cannot shift the risk to the right and the left, and then you basically make profit without liability. The Prophet ﷺ said in a hadith reported by Aisha, al-kharaj bil-daman. Al-kharaj bil-daman means what? Kharaj is profit. Daman is liability. So kharaj is contingent upon, linked to, tied to, rests on, follows, goes with, hand in hand, hand in glove, daman. Is it understandable? You can't make money off of air. So capital has to be responsible. There has got to be some liability in order for you to be deserving of profit. So if لا تبع ما ليس عندك here, you go and sell, you know, so you know, you see this, Danny's laptop, it's a nice laptop. You go to Muhammad and you sell him Danny's laptop without taking Danny's permission or anything. You just sell him Danny's laptop for $1,000. And then you go to Danny and buy it for $800. Have you been responsible for anything, liable for anything here? Absolutely not. You just sold it for $1,000, went and bought it. But we're talking about this laptop. This laptop. There is a difference between bay al-ayn and bay al-sifa. This particular item I am selling now. But if it is a describable, something that can be described, and I go do the same thing about something that can be prescribed, like I can go to you and tell you, You want a brand new Kia Soul for $14,000, and I give you a list of descriptions that are like completely accurate. $14,000, and then I go and buy that and sell it to you. That would be a different story, because this is not, although, you know, whether we will agree that these can be valid transactions in Salem or not, that's a different story. But I believe that these would be valid transactions in Salem, which is deferred, which is advanced payment sales, which we will come to this later, because that particular item is one of many, and it is available in the market, and I can go and get it. That would be a different thing. So is that clear? The difference between this particular item and between getting you an item that is out there in the market, these are two different scenarios. But لا تبع ما ليس عندك was meant to basically make capital responsible, accountable, and it was meant also to cut out the intermediaries. Cut out the intermediaries. What happens is, why is it that we have farmers that complain of financial hardship all the time, and we have consumers that complain of inflated prices all the time? It is because we have so many intermediaries that are making a profit off of air. And you will find throughout the fiqh of financial transactions, particularly here the fiqh of sales, that Islam intends to remove the intermediaries, to allow, you know, the movement of goods as directly as possible from the producer to the consumer. So here, لا تبع ما ليس عندك, this man basically went and bought this, you know, sold this laptop and then bought it. That man is an intermediary, made a profit, had the seller and the actual buyer who wanted the commodity for themselves agreed among themselves. They would have cut out that intermediary. The seller may have made a little bit more money. The buyer may have paid a little bit less money, and they would have benefited in this way. So لا تبع ما ليس عندك is an important concept. ما ليس بمملوك. So it has to be owned. So لا تبع ما ليس عندك, where is it here? It is here. Where is it here? Where does it belong here? ما ليس عندك? Pillars, conditions, yeah, here. Owned. The conditions. So in both classifications we find it. Where is it here? Accountability. Then the Sheikh said, and we will take just one more and then a break before we come back. The Sheikh rahimahullah ta'ala said, وَلَا بَيْعُ مَا لَا نَفْعَ فِيهِ كَالْحَشَرَاتِ. It is also impermissible to sell something useless, such as insects. It's also impermissible to sell something useless, such as insects. Two things that I wanted to say here. What is the foundation of this? You would not find this in secular law, because obviously in secular law it doesn't matter, you know, as far as there is mutual agreement. But like I said, in Islam, it within that teleological worldview that recognizes devotion of God as the ultimate good, Islam is concerned about your spiritual well-being, your moral well-being. It's not just the law. It is predominantly a deen, you know, that has laws, and in this sense, the laws fit into the basically the larger context of ensuring the social well-being, communal well-being, and your own spiritual and moral well-being. If it is immoral or amoral for you, it is haram, it is forbidden for you, even if there is taradi, even if there is mutual consent. even if there is mutual consent. So here, useless things you cannot sell because they don't fit into this framework. And the one thing that I also wanted to mention here, Allah said, وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ in Surah Al-Baqarah, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ in Surah Al-Nisa'. Don't devour, consume your property amongst yourselves unjustly. This is clear. And we should basically understand this concept. The examples that the mashayikh give in their books may apply, may be relevant to their times, may not be relevant to our times. Let us say particular insects have particular uses and they're really valuable, and you go out and collect those insects and sell them. And within, you know, because they did not, you know, like cockroaches, for instance. Like, why would anyone sell, you know, in their times, why would anyone sell cockroaches? Who would buy cockroaches except someone who is a little bit challenged? But but maybe at one point things will have some uses, like laboratory uses or some uses. And in this case, if there is actual benefit, then their sale may be, in this case, permissible. And that brings us to the end of this lecture. We will come back and talk about the rest of the forbidden sales in 7 minutes, inshallah. We come back in 7 minutes to talk about the rest of the forbidden sales and see how these detailed rulings relate to the principles and guidelines and the framework that we talked about. Qul qawli hadha astaghfirullah li wa lakum subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.